From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, Washington Post fact-checker editor Glenn Kessler talks about the process he uses to separate political statements that are factually true from ones that aren't, and where he draws the line between spin, misleading remarks, and outright lies. We'll talk about how news consumers use fact-checking and look into the veracity of administration comments on trade, Korean denuclearization, and the real death toll of Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. We'll also talk about the bigger question of whether the existence of fact-checking makes leaders more likely to tell the truth. Our conversation starts after this short break. Politicians have this way of spinning things. They play up the mistakes and weaknesses of their adversaries and the policies they create while minimizing their own flaws. But here's a big question. Where is the line between spin and lying? And how can we know when a leader has crossed it? Enter the fact checker. From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The Washington Post's fact-checker column was conceived as a temporary feature during the 2008 election season. But, you know, it became clear that there was no shortage of political statements to fact-check. It was made a permanent feature early in 2011. The Post's rating system relies on characters from a classic children's story, one Pinocchio for a statement that checks out as mostly true, down to four Pinocchios for the ones that are pure malarkey. Oh, and there is the rare but wonderful Geppetto rating. That's reserved for statements that sound like they must be lies but turn out to be factual. We wanted to know more about the process of fact-checking, so we've invited the fact-checker himself, chief writer and editor for the column, Glenn Kessler. Glenn, welcome to Think.
Glad to be with you.
Love to jump in here and talk about what you've been working on for the past few days. President Trump had a lot to say after the meeting with Kim Jong-un in Singapore. For one thing, he called the document they signed very, very comprehensive. Is it very, very comprehensive?
No, it's actually the complete opposite of that. As part of the fact check, I looked back and showed that previous documents that North Korea has signed, dating back to 1992, were actually much more comprehensive and much more detailed, laying out specific steps and specific things that were going to happen. I actually, you know, before I was the fact checker for the Washington Post, I was diplomatic correspondent for the Post for 9 years, and I spent a lot of that time writing about different efforts to try to reach an agreement with North Korea on limiting its nuclear ambitions. It's a very complex, difficult process, and North Korea has a long history of agreeing to things that then it never fulfills. And in this case, what the president claimed was very, very comprehensive is far short of those earlier efforts to get North Korea to give up its nuclear programs.
So there was precedent, for example, was it 1992, for broad pledges of denuclearization that, as we know, didn't really pan out?
Exactly. And, you know, the North Koreans have a different definition of what denuclearization means than the Americans have. And that's been a stumbling block as well. But it was very striking going back and looking at the 1992 declaration between North Korea and South Korea, or looking at the declarations that George W. Bush's administration negotiated with North Korea, and to see how specifically detailed it was about exactly what North Korea was going to do, and yet again, North Korea failed to live up to it, any of those pledges.
Does the pledge in this agreement to work toward, and those are the exact words, complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, create wiggle room ultimately for both sides?
Well, that is a pledge that falls on the part of North Korea, not so much the United States. And already you see the one thing that was missing from this declaration is the usual reference to how they were going to do step-by-step actions or action for action. Which you might have said that's an advance, because before North Korea would use the step-by-step process to really drag things out. But work toward could be perceived as simply step-by-step, but without saying it explicitly. And in fact, already the North Korean news agency has reported that what Trump and Kim agreed to was a step-by-step process. One of the things that the Bush administration found was that when they thought they had reached oral agreements with North Korea about things that were going to happen, and it wasn't written down, but they had an oral agreement. But then when they came back and said, all right, this is what we agreed, the North Koreans would say, no, no, we didn't agree to that because it's not written down. Hmm. And the Bush people would say, well, wait a second, we had an oral agreement. And the North Koreans would say, well, that's not what we remember. And in fact, this administration has already experienced this phenomenon because you may remember a few weeks ago that North Korea blew up its launch facility.
Right.
And Pompeo, Secretary of State Pompeo, thought he had had a verbal agreement to allow for U.S. observers there as well as the ability to get some samples of the area. And then the North Koreans said no, and they didn't let those people come. They just only let the select group of media watch them destroy it. And one might argue that that was a big mistake because the North Koreans could well have been covering up evidence that would have been useful as part of a nuclear agreement.
So for this to work, there has to be some kind of agreement ultimately of an allowance for comprehensive external inspections. Is that right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that is what ended up killing the Bush efforts to deal with this problem because, again, they thought they had an oral agreement. And then when they tried to negotiate the actual agreement for verification, the North Koreans said this is way too intrusive. In fact, you know, there was a dispute a few weeks ago about the Libya model because National Security Advisor John Bolton had described a Libya model, which some people interpreted as meaning Gaddafi ultimately being killed. But actually what Bolton was referring to was the Libyan model of verification. And in 2007, when the Bush administration tried to propose a Libyan model of verification, which included, you know, being able to go to various facilities and making inspections, the North Koreans rejected it completely and said, we're never going to agree to that kind of verification scheme.
So you talked about the vagaries of oral agreements. To that end, the president of the United States seems to have promised to suspend joint military training exercises with South Korea. Obviously, this looks like a win to North Korea. President Trump is pitching it as a cost saver for the United States. What did you find out about that?
Well, it's interesting. The president acts as if he's been told a figure, the way he talks about it. But the Pentagon says it has no figure for what this would cost. And frankly, it's just a training exercise. Those soldiers and airmen are still going to need training. That's not going to stop. It's just the question is whether or not you do training in South Korea or you do training in Guam or some other place. So it's really hard to say that there would be any significant cost savings. And in the context of a $700 billion annual budget, I would imagine that it's chump change.
Did the United States give billions of dollars to North Korea during the Clinton administration, as President Trump says, and get nothing in return?
No, that is incorrect. The United States was committed under the agreed framework to provide fuel oil to North Korea on a regular basis. This was ostensibly to make up for the shutdown of their nuclear reactor, even though the nuclear reactor was never connected to the electrical grid. But anyway, there was one of those diplomatic face-saving things. The United States offered to provide fuel oil. The cost for that, depending on what years you use, was about $400 to $500 million, far less than a billion. And they actually did get something in return, which is that for almost 10 years, the plutonium that was stored in the fuel rods in that reactor was kept in cooling ponds under constant 24-hour, 7-day-a-week supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency. And it was only when the Bush administration decided that North Korea had been cheating on the deal and pulled out of it and, by doing so, suspended the supply of fuel oil, that the North Koreans kicked out the IAEA inspectors, broke the seals, removed the fuel rods, reprocessed the plutonium, and started building nuclear weapons.
Is it possible the North Korean nuclear program was conceived primarily as an economic generator for that country?
Well, I don't know about it as an economic generator. It's been something that's been very costly for the country, but it would certainly employ people. It's like I said, the reactor that produced the plutonium was never connected to the electrical grid. It was simply to make the raw material for nuclear bombs. They also have facilities, which we don't know where they are, but they have facilities for the enrichment of uranium. And to acquire those materials in order to build those facilities, they had to use a lot of their hard currency and get stuff smuggled in over the years. But on the other hand, you know, it's been the Kim family's ace in the hole to give itself this rather poor country, to give this poor country a kind of a place at the grown-ups table. And it's paid off in spades in the last week, given the reception that the president gave the North Korean leader.
Yeah, well, President Trump is characterizing himself as giving up nothing in meeting with Kim. Lots of foreign policy experts see the entire meeting as a kind of concession.
Yes, it's very much a concession. This is normally the kind of thing that would come at the end of a process as a bit of a reward. You dangle it out there. You know, if these things are achieved, we will then have a meeting and signify your place in the international community. The Trump administration has decided to do it backwards. First a meeting, and now comes the hard work of actually trying to implement some sort of agreement, as opposed to the general way it's done in the past.
Help us understand that the reference the president made to the Obama administration paying to get U.S. hostages released from Iran.
Right. Well, first of all, there were hostages or detainees, probably the proper way to describe them, in North Korea during the Obama administration, and they were released. In one case, Obama sent former President Bill Clinton there to obtain the release. And Obama didn't have to, quote-unquote, pay anything for those hostages. In the case of Iran, it's a little bit more murky. There were four detainees, including a colleague of mine at the Washington Post, a reporter, and they were released on the same day that a plane full of $400 million worth of currency arrived in Tehran. And that money was provided to settle a long-standing dispute that Iran had had against the United States, because they had once paid $400 million for some fighter jets. There was a revolution. The U.S. never delivered on the equipment. And Iran has been demanding for decades its money back, along with interest. So the Obama administration settled that outstanding dispute, which amounted to $400 billion for the original principal plus $1.3 billion in interest. And it worked out that the transaction happened on the same day. So from one perspective, it was a return of Iranian money that the U.S. owed. It just happened to be on the same day as the day that the detainees were released. The State Department has always maintained that they used the possibility of settling this outstanding dispute as leverage to ensure the release of the detainees, but critics have looked at it and said, no, this was a payoff, even though, as I noted, this was actually Iran's money that the U.S. has kept for, since 1979.
My guest is Glenn Kessler. He's editor and chief writer for the Washington Post's Fact Checker feature. We're talking today about what it takes to check the facts on major news stories. If you would like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter at @KERAThink.
My name's Darian Tesser, and I'm from Carlsbad, California. If you want to really understand news, you need to look at several sources and work it out for yourself. Not everyone is going to know that. Even if you just search on Google, they have their own ways of getting you the news versus if you search different ways and go to different sites.
Penelope LM from France. I usually read newspapers that have been in that space for a long time. So you just assume that since they've built all this reputation, they wouldn't, they would be trustworthy, because if they're, it's found that they're not, then they're going to ruin their, like, everything they've built over the years. So that's why I go for those news sources rather than more recent ones.
My name is Thomas Michael. I'm from Miami, Florida. You know, I try and look at a variety of news sources, not just one. And I guess you can make the assumption if it's reported in multiple news sources, it's fairly accurate for the most part.
My name is Mallory Geneva, and I'm from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. There's a lot of fake news going around, especially since the main outlet for news is like Facebook or Instagram. That's where people mainly get their stuff, not newspapers anymore.
I'm Wayne Smith from Melbourne, Australia. Well, I never believe anything until I see it myself, to be honest.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You just heard a little collection of voices of people that we have met on the street since we have arrived here in D.C. last week. My guest this hour is Glenn Kessler. He's editor-in-chief writer for the Washington Post's Fact Checker feature. He joins us actually from a studio across town at the Washington Post, and we're talking today about his job and what it takes to check the facts. People listening to the show thus far, Glenn, could be forgiven for thinking that somehow this is just a way to pick on President Trump, although this was made a permanent feature of the Post when Barack Obama was in the White House. There are hundreds of public statements made by U.S. politicians from both parties on any given day. Will you talk a little bit about how you make decisions about which claims and statements to fact check?
Yes, of course. First of all, a lot of the things we fact check come from our readers. I'd say probably about 50% of the claims we look at are based on reader questions. They at the bottom of every fact check, there's a little button they can click and they can fill in a form if they heard something fishy and they want it checked out. Specifically, we try to write about things that are newsworthy and can allow us to explore issues in debt. Issues in depth. The real point of the fact checker is to illuminate and explain complex policy issues. Because a big problem is that politicians speak in shorthand. They're salespeople. They're trying to sell you on a policy, and they're not going to necessarily get into the nuances that might make you think less of that policy. Or they might try to attack someone else's policies. And again, they're not going to get into the details. So my hope is that if you are a regular reader of the fact checker, you will come away with a better understanding of tax policy, economic policy, foreign policy, healthcare policy. So we look for meaty issues. And so the claim we are checking is really just a jumping off point for us to write in detail about the Affordable Care Act or about, you know, North Korean nuclear programs, something like that. So it has to be a big issue. We're not going to play gotcha. You know, politicians make mistakes. And in fact, we have a policy that if a politician comes to us and says, you know, I messed up there. I stepped too forward on my skis, or I had a brain freeze and I made an error there, we will generally not award the Pinocchios. We might still do the fact check because it allows us to get in depth on an important issue, but we're not going to just, if they said they made an error, we're not going to give them the Pinocchios. I will note very few politicians will accept that offer. I've had one of the most senior members of Congress once say to me, look, I'll take the Pinocchios rather than admit I was wrong. So that's what we're trying to look for. And we look for, like I said, we look for things that are in the news. So if, say, there's a gun shooting, we might end up doing a number of fact checks having to be that are related to guns. And in part, that's because readers are asking us questions. That's also because politicians are talking about that. During the whole issue about repealing the Affordable Care Act, we did many, many healthcare fact checks. I mean, one frankly, one issue we face at the moment is that power is largely centered right now in the hands of the Republican Party. You have the president and you have the leaders of both houses of Congress held by Republicans. They tend to dominate the news. In particular, the president overwhelms the news. He's constantly talking and he's tweeting. And we find it difficult to achieve the kind of balance we used to when there was divided government, and we would fact-check equally both the Democrats and the Republicans. So if you have readers out there and they hear claims made by Democrats that they think are fishy, please contact us, because we are on the lookout for them. We can't only fact-check Donald Trump, which is what we seem to do on a pretty regular basis.
So you know that politicians are reading the column because they will get in touch with you and say, hey, that's not fair, this shouldn't have gotten three Pinocchios or whatever. Do you actually see any evidence that because of your column, they're being a little more careful to tell only the truth?
Yeah, I have seen evidence of that. In fact, there's just recently, just in the last day or so, a study was produced by a PhD student at Stanford University where she looked at the impact of fact checks by myself, the Washington Post fact checker, PolitiFact and factcheck.org. And she did find pretty strong evidence that politicians adjusted their statements in response to the fact checks. And I have a number of examples I can remember when that happened. And in fact, you know, Barack Obama was, you know, if he got hit with four Pinocchios, he tended not to ever say that thing again. It's a different situation with President Trump. President Trump, on a number of occasions, has talked about how he dislikes getting Pinocchios. And he talks about, you know, I'm just a little 100th off, don't give me Pinocchios. So he's clearly watching closely. I don't see much evidence that he necessarily changes what he says. What is particularly noteworthy about President Trump is that he will say things over and over again, no matter how often it's been fact-checked. I mean, he's constantly gotten wrong the U.S. contribution to NATO. He said it again yesterday at the press conference in Singapore, putting the spin on it that was completely false. He says repeatedly, in fact, by our count, I think it's now 75 times he has said he passed the biggest tax cut in U.S. history. And it's only the eighth largest in U.S. history. But he won't. He likes the way that sounds, and so he's just going to keep saying it.
So when fact-checking, how do you decide whose information is trustworthy? So let's say there's a budget claim. There's only so far you can go back to the source. Do you assume that a government agency like the OMB is a reliable backstop? Whose data are unassailable for purposes of fact-checking?
Well, that's a good question. I would not say OMB is unassailable. That's the Office of Management and Budget, which is an arm of the White House. And depending who runs the White House, they're going to put their spin on the numbers. A more reliable source in terms of the budget would be the Congressional Budget Office. That is a nonpartisan agency, and you know, with very professional staff there. And you know, the leadership of Congress appoints the head of it. So the Republican leaders appointed the head of the agency. He is a Republican, but a very respected economist. And he gave the Republicans fits last year with the different measures they had as to what the impact of repeal of the Affordable Care Act would be. Because under their analysis, you had, you know, at the end of the process, you had, you know, 20 to 30 million fewer people with health insurance. So the CBO is certainly a pretty good place to go. They're not infallible. You know, you also have any professional agencies like the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which does lots of data. You have the Census Bureau. And those are generally pretty trustworthy, no matter who was in power, whoever is in charge of the U.S. government.
So as you mentioned, there are a number of organizations doing fact-checking now. There is you at the Fact Checker at the Washington Post. There's PolitiFact. Even Snopes is operating, functioning somewhat in this capacity these days. Can fact-checkers working in good faith reach different conclusions about the veracity of a story?
I would say about, yes, it can certainly happen. It's not, not so much what the truth is. Where the dispute might be would be what the final rating is. Mm-hmm. PolitiFact has a scale that is somewhat similar to ours, but they do, you know, they don't have Pinocchio's. They have a little meter there. So it's mostly true, half true, mostly false.
Pants on fire, right?
Yeah, false and then pants on fire. So they have like two gradations of false. The false and pants on fire is kind of like our four Pinocchios. Factcheck.org does not do ratings. And they're affiliated with the University of Pennsylvania, and so that's an academic institution. And so they always viewed the ratings as a gimmick, which I fully plead guilty to. It's just an easy way for people to get their head around what our bottom line is. Snopes doesn't do a... I guess they have a thing, like it's like a red and green thing, that like false, half true. So the dispute may be what the final rating is. And sometimes that happens because we're rating slightly different versions of the same point. There was an incident where Joe Biden, who was a man who was often had trouble with the facts, Joe Biden was touring around in Pennsylvania. And on the same day, he said, it's something to do with Flint and rape statistics. It was something like... you know, that rapes went up two times after they reduced the police force. Well, he said that once. Later in the day, he said that rape went up three times. And then later in the day, he said rape went up four times. So we actually all ended up with slightly different ratings because we were rating different versions. So like, you know, PolitiFact rated two times and we rated the four times. We didn't even know he had different versions of the same statement. So... the dispute might be more like, you know, what the final rating is. There was actually, and there's lots of academic studies now being done of fact-checking because it's a big, burgeoning new area of journalism. And they found that that the three main fact-checkers agreed with the outcome 90 to 95% of the time. So it happens occasionally, but... it's not particularly important.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The judgment call, Glenn, between, say, two Pinocchios and three seems somewhat subjective. Do you have any philosophy that dictates which way you will go in a toss-up?
Well, yeah. It's a big crossing line to go from two or three. And we have increasingly tried to explain our reasoning. But I will readily admit that, you know, if someone else were running the fact checker, they might come, you know, my three might be their two, or the other way around. Now, I've now been doing it for 7 years. I believe we are rather internally consistent now. And so it is what it is. Two means that there's pretty good factual basis for what you're saying, but you might be exaggerating or taking it out of context. With the three is where it gets more and more untethered from reality. So, there's an example of, Ted Cruz had once taken a study about the effectiveness of women in the Marines, and he had... you know, he did cite something that was from the study, but he, ignored all sorts of other contrary evidence to his point. So it wasn't a four Pinocchio because it was based, his point was in the study, but it was only a small part of it. So he really took it to an extreme. I once gave Barack Obama three Pinocchios because he had this way of talking about the Chrysler bailout, where he said that Chrysler had rewarded, Chrysler had repaid every dime and more of what had been extended during his presidency. And Obama was doing that, but he was ignoring the loan that Bush gave Chrysler. Hmm. And he did that by slipping in the words, in my presidency. Obama was very, very tricky in the way he phrased things to make it, technically correct.
Has this work affected your sort of trust in humanity, or have you throughout your journalistic career expected politicians to tell you lies?
Well, long before I took this job, I used to joke that my memoir would be titled Waiting for People to Lie to Me. and that's because I've covered just about every building in Washington, and so I've staked out, stood outside, closed doors in the halls of Congress, waiting for people to come out and say what happened inside. I've stood outside, embassies or diplomatic events, waiting for the Secretary of State to come out and explain what happened. I covered the White House, so I was often waiting to hear what the president or the spokesman would say. So, I would say that the biggest thing I have noted to my dismay since taking this job is that it's lowered my it's made me more aware of the fact that there are many sloppy reporters out there who are not really careful on their own with the facts, and are too quick to cite something that a politician says without actually checking it out. And a lot of times a politician might come to me and say, well, my source for this was here. There's sometimes they'll even say it was something that was in the Washington Post. And then we dig into it and realize, the reporter got this wrong. There's actually an incident of this very recently. You might have seen the reports of...
Let me have you take a break right there, and we'll get that story in just a moment. My guest is Glenn Kessler, editor and chief writer for the Washington Post's Fact Checker feature. We're talking today about what it takes to check the facts. If you want to join the conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372. From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Glenn Kessler. He is editor and chief writer for the Washington Post's Fact Checker feature. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Glenn, before the break, you were talking about untangling the kind of vortex of misinformation that happens when a politician misstates a fact, a reporter writes that fact into a story, and then the politician turns around and cites the appearance in a publication like the Washington Post as confirmation that something must be true.
That's right. And, I was saying that, I've learned over time that there are some pretty sloppy reporters out there. The example I was going to give, which I assume your listeners would have heard of, is there was a Harvard report that came out a couple of weeks ago, which reported that, as this is how it was reported in the media, that 4,645, I believe was the number, people died in Puerto Rico during the hurricane Maria. And it got a lot of headlines, and I got interested and actually read the report, the Harvard report. And it really didn't say that at all. And in fact, it gave a range of 800 to 8,000. You dug a little deeper into the report, and you think, why does it have such a wide range? Because the 4,000 number was just a midpoint. And it turns out they had done a survey. They surveyed 104 barrios across Puerto Rico, and they counted 15 deaths that could be attributed to the hurricane or the aftermath of the hurricane. And from that, they extrapolated that number. So it's a really, really misleading number. And in particularly because there have already been other counts by people who actually looked at the death certificates, which range pretty roughly. I found five such studies based on death certificates. And it was about 1,000, a little more. And then in response to the Harvard study, Puerto Rico finally made the rest of the data. The data before was somewhat incomplete. And what you saw was about 1,300 excess deaths, still within the range and still within the bottom part of that Harvard range. But over and over, people were reporting this 4,000 number as if it were a hard fact, and never explaining that it was a guesstimate based on a pretty, you know, extreme extrapolation of a small amount of data. And you know, and in fact, the giveaway that this was a pretty suspect number was that the margin of error was almost as large as the number itself. It was 4,000, you know, 400 plus or minus 3,200. So it should have been a number that was should not have been reported at all. And in fact, if you look at the original release that Harvard put out about the study, they don't mention a number. It's not in their headline. It's just buried in the report. And someone picked it out, did a news report, and then the gazillion reporters wrote about it without actually reading the study itself. That's just sloppy journalism.
Yeah, one thing I really like about the Fact Checker is that it's kind of a show your work exercise, and it's very transparent. A lot of people are talking about the need for more transparency in journalism overall.
Right. I mean, the Washington Post Fact Checker was one of the early fact checkers, but you know now it is an international movement. In 2010, there were only 4 fact checkers in the world. Right now, there are 150, and it's constantly growing. And I'm on the board of the International Fact Checking Network, and we have put together guidelines for groups if they want to be verified as an official fact checker. You have to meet certain criteria, and one of the criteria is transparency, to show your work. You have to be able to allow readers or viewers to replicate what you did. So, you know, it has to be all there so they can actually look at the documents themselves, or they can figure out how you did it. And it's a really important part of fact-checking, and should be increasingly an important part of journalism.
How does fact-checking work in places where there is no guarantee of press freedom?
It's difficult. It is difficult. It varies. I trained people in Morocco, which is a difficult place to do fact-checking. I just came back at the behest of the State Department from training people in Panama, which has some reasonable amount of press freedom, but it's not necessarily as good as in the United States. There's a fact-checking organization in Turkey, which has seen quite a crackdown on press freedom, though interestingly, the Turkish government has not touched them. And I think one reason for that is because they fact-check everyone. They're hard on everyone. So not only hard on the government, but also on the opposition groups. And that's an important part of being a good fact-checker, is to make sure that you aren't viewed in any way as, you know, towing a partisan line, but you are just equal opportunity on everyone. And I think one reason why fact-checking has had such explosive growth is because it's a really good way towards, it's kind of an entryway into accountability journalism in societies that don't have a tradition of accountability journalism.
All right. I was going to take a call here. Okay. We have James on the line in Dallas. Hi, James.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
My question was this. Fact-checking from the media shows on TV, I find myself hopping back and forth between different shows, and it's so much politically charged information. I don't find any truth in anything. I'm having trouble getting some objective facts, and I wonder if there's any truth finding for especially the CNBCs and CNNs and Hannity's and Tucker Carlson's. Is there any kind of validity, or should I just look at it as entertainment?
Thanks for your call.
Well, you should have a skeptical view about anything you read or watch. Just because it's written down or you see it on TV, you should not necessarily believe it. You should really, there's an old journalism saying, you know, if your mother says she loves you, check it out. And I think any news consumer should have the same attitude.
What is a Geppetto, by the way, and how often do you give out Geppettos?
Well, the Geppetto checkmark is reserved for statements that are true. We tend to use that for things that are unexpectedly true. And the three fact-checking organizations, and the major ones in the United States, have different approaches. Factcheck.org, if they find out a statement is true, they stop work and don't write anything. Huh. PolitiFact will write about a number of statements that are true, even if you might think it's self-evidently true. What we try to do is keep it focused on claims that when you first saw it, you'd say, God, is that possible? And then it turns out it is. So, for instance, one of these that has been consistently popular that people keep going back to is there was Rob Portman, the senator from Ohio, said that there were 100,000 people that retire every day in the United States. Sounds like a huge number, but mm-hmm. It is indeed true. 100,000 people every single day retire in the United States.
Wow. Is there anything you can do about claims that are subjective by nature? So, for example, if one politician calls another one racist or sexist, is there a way to verify a claim about an overall character trait?
That's something I would probably shy away from. You can't fact check opinion. Mm-hmm. Now, I guess if someone said this person is racist, you could try to document whether or not they had made statements that could be construed as racist, or they'd done, racially charged things, that sort of thing, but it's more of an opinion. This is something that Donald Trump has picked up on. One of the times he was quoted as saying, I'm going to say something different. I'm going to say, I think this is the case. And that way they can't give me Pinocchios.
And can you, if he does that? I mean, have you followed up on those sorts of statements?
Well, like I said, if it's opinion, we're not going to fact check it. But if he has a number there that's totally phony, we will certainly fact check it.
All right, let's go back to the phones. You're listening to Think from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, now on the phone we have Corby in Frisco. Hi, Corby.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Okay, thanks for taking my call. When a professional is applying for a job and they purposely lie about qualifications or information in their job and mislead, they often lose their job. What can we do, and why are politicians and even the presidents allowed to do this? And will there ever be any guidelines or legislation to stop or outlaw this?
Thanks for your call.
Well, that's an interesting question. There was actually a Supreme Court case a few years ago because I think it was Ohio had passed a law saying that you couldn't put false information in campaign advertisements. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And my recollection is that they basically said, no, there's no requirement for them to tell the truth. If you don't like what a politician is saying or how they're doing their job, the remedy is to go and make sure you vote. That's the remedy.
Here's something I'm curious about in terms of the patterns you've noticed. Do candidates for public office tend to lie more in primary season or when they're running against somebody from the other party in a general election?
Well, I haven't done a study one way or the other. I mean, it really depends on the threat they face at that moment to their political career. If they're in a very hard-fought primary season, they're going to fling mud at the other person. Same thing with the general. The best possible option is to go positive, but you're only going to do that if you don't feel a threat.
Why is it so hard for us to believe that a candidate or a leader that we really like has told a lie, and so easy for us to believe that somebody we don't care for is lying?
Well, it's the problem is people are much more receptive to information that confirms their preconceived beliefs. So And I see this all the time with the reactions to the fact checks. It's just the way human nature is. There was a really fascinating study done. It's too complicated to try to explain at the moment, but there was a study done where, you know, even people with extremely high education, when presented with information that challenged their preconceived beliefs, would reorder the information to make it seem as if it confirmed what they already believed.
Wow.
So it's just a very hard human trait to get past.
Are you thinking much about the fact that candidates may use your fact checks against their opponents? Is that something that bothers you, that you just have to live with? Do you like it?
Well, I can't say I necessarily like it, it's done all the time. In fact, if you go to the Washington Post website, for our 10th anniversary, we put together a video where you see, Mitch McConnell in the middle of a debate turns to the moderator and say, well, I just want to point out the Washington Post gave her 4 Pinocchios for what she just said. Newt Gingrich once asked a super PAC to take down an ad because it got 4 Pinocchios. So we put the fact checks out there to help people have information to be better consumers of news and to understand complex policy issues. But obviously, with those Pinocchios are going to be cited, and they're in advertising. In the fact checking business, it's known as weaponizing the fact check.
Do your colleagues consult with you before they publish things that they're not quite sure about?
It's not like I'm a fact checker for the Washington Post.
Right.
I fact check politicians. If they consult with me, it's because I used to cover foreign policy or domestic policy, a particular issue that I might have an expertise in.
Glenn Kessler is editor and chief writer for the Washington Post's Fact Checker feature. Glenn, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
You're welcome.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find us on Twitter at KERAThink, and the hashtag for this week is ThinkInDC. You can subscribe to the podcast using any podcast app, or you can go to our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.